Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Mary McDougall and joining me today we have Hamish Bailey, lead manager of the Ruffer Investment Company. Ruffer is one of the few investment trusts that has a multi-asset portfolio focused on wealth preservation and has performed very well over the past year thanks to a rebound in equity markets, a very successful Bitcoin trade, and its manager's rigorous focus on inflation protection. Hamish joined Ruffer in 2002 and founded its Edinburgh office in 2009. Hamish, thank you for joining me. How are you?
Thank you, Mary. Very well, and thank you for having me on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. So to kick off, in your annual report, which I must say is an excellent read, came out earlier this month, you describe Ruffer Investment Company as an all-weather portfolio. Please, can you explain what you mean by this?
Sure. I think it's about taking the stress out of people's investment decisions, because if we're doing a good job for our investors, then we should be making a steady return for them in both good markets and bad markets. So you'll never hear from Ruffer, sorry, you know, terrible markets, down 25%, but we've done well because we're only down 20. That's just not in our DNA. So our investors shouldn't have to worry if stock markets going up, down or sideways. We should be doing the same job for them. And the reality is that most people's lives are aligned with the economic cycle. You know, people don't lose their jobs in good times. They don't get their bonus cut in good times. So, you know, it doesn't make much sense to have your rainy day pot of savings aligned with everything else in your life. So I guess we're there as a diversifier to be called upon in a crisis. And of course, we strongly believe that the strength of compounding is in our favor. By not losing money in a crisis, we should be able to produce better returns for investors over the long run.
And inflation is a hot topic that's worrying investors at the moment. And Ruffer has been raising concerns about inflation for years. And in your annual report, it says conviction in the long-term inflationary endgame has never been higher, to quote. Please, can you elaborate on why you think that's the case?
Yes. So you correctly identify that it's been some time that we've been talking about inflation and positioning the portfolio for inflation. I think COVID has really been a game changer in terms of the evolution of inflationary dynamics. And I'll perhaps come back to that in a second. But I think at the moment, the inflation debate is really revolving around short-term factors, you know, the base effects on prices, owner imputed rents, inflation expectations, what's the oil price going to do, all these quite small factors that have a big impact in the short term. But they push the debate into the realm of, is this transitory or not? And I think miss some of the more important aspects of the broader picture. So I think it's safe to say that inflation has proved to be more stubborn in the last 18 months than the transitory crowd expected. The individual components of inflation have ebbed and flowed, but a bit like a game of whack-a-mole, as soon as one subsides, there seems to be another supply side shortage to replace it. So those short-term inflationary dynamics are definitely pushing prices up at the moment. But let's perhaps take a step back and look at the longer-term factors, because this is where our focus lies. And I think if you think about an autumn bonfire, that's a good place to start. You know, for the last decade, central bankers have been acting sort of faced with a soggy pile of leaves because of all the deflationary forces in the world. And that might be regulation of the banks. It might be cheap labor and production in China and the Far East. It might be the internet and the availability of price comparison, etc. Now, all those things appear to be in retreat. And I would also put on top of that, globalization appears to be in retreat. So think trade wars, think regulation of big tech. Of course, China can only join the global labor market once. That's not something that will be repeated. And actually, it's becoming more expensive to be doing business in these far-flung places. And I'd also say that supply chains are moving both physically, i.e. towards home markets, and also metaphorically from a just-in-time model to a just-in-case model. That's sort of one of the impacts of COVID. So fascinatingly, we've sort of you know, had these long-term factors that would suggest to us that some of the disinflationary pressures are subsiding, reversing, and we now have the perfect accelerant, the fire lighter, if you like, in the shape of COVID, to get the fire going and ignite that dry tinder. So why do I say that? Well, I think when we look back, probably the most important change that we'll see in the last 18 months from the prospect of the debate on inflation is the passing of the baton of stimulus from central banks to governments. So if you think post financial crisis in 2008, it was all down to central banks to try and, you know, lower interest rates, quantitative easing, all these things to try and stimulate economic growth. And what we saw with the onset of COVID was governments, either fiscal channel, taking over that support. And Milton Friedman, you know, had a great quote where he said there was nothing so permanent as a temporary government scheme. And I think that is the risk in this transition, is that politicians are not good at reversing policies which people will vote for very obvious reasons. So I think what we may see is that many of the things that are deemed to be temporary will prove to be permanent in terms of support for the economy. So that's one factor I would point to in COVID. The other is sort of political imperative. Clearly, borrowing has gone up enormously through the COVID crisis, and there's a political imperative to keep the real cost of borrowing low. I remember Rishi Sunak's last budget, but he was asked, you know, aren't you worried about the amount of debt and that the UK is now carrying? He said, well, I'm not worried about the amount of debt because the cost of servicing that is very low at the moment, and we should be making the most of that. And in some ways, he's quite right about that. But what he said, you know, the thing that keeps him awake effectively is the cost of debt going up. So what you can see there is really financial repression is going to be the path forward. Keep the cost of borrowing very low, and probably a fairly relaxed view on inflation. So I think those things are what get us really excited about inflation at the moment. And I'm sure, you know, we'll come on later to talk about the sort of behavioural aspects of inflation, because clearly they are very important. That once this snowball starts rolling, it can you know, gather size and pace quite quickly.
That's really interesting. So what you're saying is that there are long-term inflationary pressures. This would usually be eased by putting up interest rates, but the government needs to keep the cost of borrowing low.
Is that right?
The Bank of England, you know, there've been reports coming out saying that rates are likely to rise sooner than had previously expected. Does an interest rates being raised too quickly, is that a concern to you?
I mean, it would be a concern if a sort of Paul Volcker sort of character emerged that was really determined to stamp out in inflation, but we don't see that. I mean, of course, there will be token gestures from the world's central banks to raise interest rates to combat inflation, but I think they're deliberately going to be behind the curve on this. So I think, yes, interest rate rises will come, but the thing is that they will lag the rise in inflation. And the reasons for that are, firstly, of course, for government finances, you know, a negative real interest rate, which is what we're talking about there, is very beneficial, because governments are heavily indebted, and that makes the cost of servicing that debt less punitive. And secondly, just sort of looking at society as a whole, you know, you look at the corporate sector, you look at the consumer sector, you know, high levels of debt in both. And so, you know, central banks have got to be careful here that they don't cut off the nose to spite the face. You know, if the effect of raising interest rates is to snuff out any economic recovery, then they've kind of defeated themselves.
So it looks like you're clearly, I think inflation is going to be with us for a while, and index-linked bonds is your main protection against that. You've got 35% of the fund in bonds, nearly all of which are inflation protected. You've got quite a lot in longer dated index linked gilts, which sell on negative real yields. What are the negative real yields on these bonds, and at what point would these become unattractive?
Yeah, so at the very long end of the UK index linked gilt market, you're on a negative 2.3% real yield at the moment. Now, to put that in context, that is pretty close to as expensive as UK index linked gilts have ever been. So does that make them deeply unattractive? Well, I think here we need to differentiate between conventional gilts, which are sort of mathematically bounded as an asset class because interest rates could only fall so much. And so, you know, you've got limited upside in conventionals and your downside is significant. In index link, because you've got two moving parts here, you've got the inflation rate and the nominal interest rate. Actually, there's a lot more to go for, you know, because if inflation picks up, and as we were just saying, interest rates stay low, and that there's nothing to stop that minus two becoming minus three, minus four, you know, in theory, maybe even, you know, minus five, although that would be an extreme event at the very long end of the curve. I mean, short dated index link gilts are already at minus five. So if you believe that inflation can keep rising and there is limited scope for central banks to raise interest rates, then I think index link gilts remain a fascinating play on inflation.
Why do you have so much more in the UK index link gilts than you do in US TIPS, which are inflation protected US treasuries? Because aren't the negative real yields deeper in the UK than they are in the US?
Yes, they are, and they always are, actually. That's not a sort of anomaly at the moment. I think the short answer is sterling, in that the dollar is, you know, the world's reserve currency, and because the conduit of inflation is often through the currency, it means that inflation in the UK is a lot more volatile than it is in the US. So that I think makes the UK index linked market more interesting. There are some other factors though. There's a huge distortion in the UK market through forced buying from pension funds. Now, you know, that probably pushes yields down. It's a permanent feature of the market, but you know, it pushes yields down, but it also leaves a comparatively smaller free float available for investors like us and your listeners. And that can be quite interesting because we always love to own assets that people might panic into. So think back to the financial crisis, you know, that was things like the Swiss franc and the Japanese yen. In the COVID crisis, it was things like volatility call options. So if you can own that asset that people need to buy in a crisis, then it can be a very powerful protection. And I think that's what index-linked gilts give you, given the comparatively sort of smaller free float. I think the other sort of niche argument that's quite often given for TIPS is that they have a deflation floor. So, you know, if you have deflation through the life of that bond, then you don't lose money. You basically have a floor on what you're repaid. I think that's quite a clever gimmick, but if you're buying TIPS, you know, for any more than a couple of years in duration, then it is pretty much a gimmick, because I don't think anyone's really expecting deflation for that period of time. So I sort of think that's a bit of an irrelevance if you're going any further out than 2-3 years. I mean, I should say that we do own some TIPS, and we have owned TIPS in the past, so opportunities do arise. I don't think, you know, there's nothing wrong with it as an asset class. It's just at the moment we find the index-linked gilts more interesting.
It's interesting what you say about pension funds, because as more money is going into defined contribution schemes, there might be less pressure on pension funds to own gilts, and that might have the reverse effect.
There are sort of two impacts there. I mean, you're right. If you look on a sort of 25-year view, yes, the money, you know, people will die, pensioners will be paid, and money will come out of these defined benefit schemes. But at the same time, as they get closer to maturity, they put more money into liability matching, which effectively means buying more gilt. So they will actually be taking money out of riskier assets and putting it into things like index-linked gilt. So it's not quite as simple as just saying that's a shrinking pot and so money will be coming out. And I also think the timescales are, you know, are long.
And you have quite a significant amount in long-dated bonds, as we've discussed, and these have a higher interest rate risk. It looks like you have various protections built in to reduce duration. I wonder if it might be sort of simpler and cheaper to just hold the shorter duration. Can you explain the thought process behind this?
Yes, I mean, this is a debate that we have had internally, and I know some of our competitor investment trusts have opted for shorter duration as well. I think the answer is that the loss in your swaptions is limited, whereas the upside in the linkers is not. So if there was a significant fall in real yields, maybe a behavioral panic or a currency crisis, then if you hold the very long dated index linked gilts, then you capture that. Your option, you know, the premium in your option is lost, but that's relatively small in comparison to how much you can make in the long dated index linked gilts. Whereas if you're holding a shorter duration, you don't get as much bang for your buck. So I think we would be sort of philosophically aligned with people who've opted for shorter durations, because the thought process here is that some of the short term inflationary dynamics perversely could be quite bad news for index-linked gilts, because it's sort of benign inflation in the form of reopening, stronger than expected economic growth, so that pushes up nominal bond yields and index-linked suffer as a result of that. Now that may not happen, but it is a distinct possibility, and we've seen it. We saw it happen a bit in the first quarter of this year, and to some extent that dynamic was around in September this year as well. So the interest rate protection, the payer swaptions, insulate us from that, but they still allow us to have that exposure to the long duration element of the index linked bonds, which could be very, very powerful if the sort of inflation environment that we've discussed comes to pass.
And in November, you invested in Bitcoin. And I think your argument in your annual report, I think your argument is that it's a store of value that can't be debased, maybe an alternative to gold. But I'm interested to know what analysis you did and how did you decide in November that was the right time to buy it?
Yeah, so I think digital gold is a good shorthand for the rationale behind it. You know, an asset that sits outside the sort of monetary system is really interesting to us, and we followed it for several years before we actually invested in Bitcoin. What sort of tipped us over the edge? I think it was the fact that if you go back, even, you know, as recently as 4, 5, 6 years ago, there was a reasonable chance that Bitcoin and actually all digital currencies, all cryptocurrencies, were worthless. And what we started to see at the tail end of last year was some institutional acceptance of cryptocurrency. So that's particularly sort of big financial institutions getting on board with the idea. And as that institutional adoption gains momentum, it becomes less likely that the asset is worthless. So we felt we could move quickly on it and gain exposure, and that proved to be the case. We took a lot of time to get comfortable on the ESG side, and particularly the environmental part of the ESG. We did a lot of work on that, and the more digging we did, the more we realized that while the data is pretty sparse on this, there's a huge incentive for for miners to source cheap energy, which usually means renewable energy. So actually, while Bitcoin is very energy intensive, it is naturally attracted to the cheapest source of energy. So that was another bit of work that went in the background. But I think the main thing that sort of encouraged us to go in was the case for it, the sort of digital gold, plus the sort of growing regulatory and institutional acceptance of it being an asset that was here to stay.
And how did you then decide in April that it was the right time to sell?
So if you think of it through the prism of it was a defensive, it was a protective asset for us, the same role that gold plays. We felt that it was getting quite hot as an asset class, both from a sort of, there were lots of leveraged instruments playing cryptocurrencies, and we all know the stories of the various tweets that were going around then. And so we felt, well, if this is a defensive asset class, it feels like actually, this is not the sort of scenario that we want going on around it. And so we took the last of our profits in April, as you say, at about $60,000. $55,000 was our last exit point, actually.
Okay, well, it's close to that now, I think. Maybe you should
have gone
past
this actually.
July.
It's gone past that. We're north of 60 now. But it's. I think for us, we keep an eye on it. It's it's not off the menu forever, but it's for the time being, we're happy with our holding in gold.
What's your thoughts on other cryptocurrencies? Do you think you'll be investing in any other ones? I know you bought some sort of Bitcoin proxies. Do you think you'll be going into other areas of the market?
Not immediately, no. The attraction of Bitcoin was that it was by far the largest of all the cryptocurrencies, and that when we talk about could it survive? Could it be worthless? That gives us a huge advantage. That's not to say that the others won't survive, but clearly if you want to hold an asset that is going to do well for you, potentially in an extreme scenario of sort of monetary currency debasement, then you want to be in the biggest ship, and that was Bitcoin.
And you said that you now prefer gold. It's been a bit of a disappointment, I think you would probably say, in recent months. Do you think gold has suffered from the Bitcoin development?
Probably. Very, very difficult to know for sure. Very difficult to track the flows, but I think that's quite likely. Does that mean that gold is redundant if cryptocurrency continues to do well? No, I don't think so. I think in extremist panic, the sort of 3,000 year pedigree that gold has probably trumps the upstart. So I would agree with you, it's been a bit disappointing in the short term, but I don't think it's tarnished as an asset class longer term.
Now let's talk about your equity weighting, which makes up about 40% of the portfolio. It's got just over half of it's in UK stocks, which is perhaps quite unusual. Why such a high UK weighting?
Yeah, it's unusual. It's unusual for us and unusual for a globally exposed investment trust. The answer is that we see really interesting value in the UK, and I don't think we're the only people to see this. You look at the amount of sort of M&A activity going on in the UK this year, clearly, particularly coming from private equity, actually, clearly others are seeing the same thing. So we have a sort of double discount on UK assets at the moment. Firstly, there was the sort of the Brexit cloud hanging over markets, and then certainly in the initial stages of COVID, the UK was deemed to be a laggard in terms of its response. So I think it's mostly that value angle. I mean, I would also say that the nature of our equity exposure at the moment is that we're looking for cyclical businesses, you know, businesses that will perform very well in an economic upturn, and that is a sort of natural offset to some of the risks that we mentioned earlier in index linked gilt. So you know, the businesses we own, I mean, they've done very well recently. They did very well in the first quarter of this year, and they should do well in an environment of reopening and rising yields. And the UK market is sort of naturally positioned for that, with, you know, energy exposure, banking exposure as well.
Yeah. So if we took Lloyds and NatWest are two of your big holdings. So a rise in interest rates would be good for these, but it seems like you're quite worried about the macro inflation background. Do you worry about these companies getting into a significant amount of bad debts?
Well, I think on the positive side, the two banks you've named there appear to have hugely over-provisioned for bad debts. Regulatory pressure, you know, going back 5, 6, 7 years, forced them to do that. And this is now starting to unwind. So that's very positive for shareholders. And the government's credit guarantees through COVID have also been very helpful to them. So that's the positive case. I think it's very important to see our holdings in financials in the portfolio context. So absolutely rising yields. That's, you know, a scenario that hurts some parts of the portfolio. We want things that will do well. Payer swap options, you know, those interest rate options we mentioned earlier, they do that. I think the UK financials do a similar job. But, you know, of course, if the economy is imploding, then banks do not do well. I don't think, you know, you can really make a case for them being a great investment in that scenario. But of course, we carry lots of protection already in the portfolio to navigate that sort of scenario. So, you know, we've got to think about how do we achieve our investment objective, that's all weather return that we're trying to produce. We need to think about the benign scenario and how we make money in that event, but also the, you know, the crisis moment. And, you know, so we hold investments in for both those scenarios, and the banks fall firmly in the sort of blue sky scenario. They should do well for us in that environment.
And it's quite eye-catching that Shell and BP are your largest two equity holdings. Clearly, recent months, it's been clear that we're not done with oil yet, and these companies have done, their share prices have done well. But it also seems like the managements have been on a program to get out of oil and fossil fuels. Do you think these companies will be able to do it?
They certainly have the ability to do so, and the incentive, you know, their survival to some extent depends on that. But I think the trickier question, and maybe this is what you're getting at, is whether they can do that in a way that will benefit their shareholders, i.e. they're not going to overpay for renewable assets and for that transition. And the jury is out on that at the moment. But I think as an investor, you have the safety net of a very cheap valuation. They're clearly not priced to achieve that transition at the moment. I mean, if you take BP, you know, as a dividend yield of 5.5%, and it's buying back a further 5-6% of its stock. So, you know, those returns to shareholders only represent 60% of their free cash flow. So there's still plenty more to reinvest into the business and fund the energy transition. So they have the ability to do it. I think whether that can be executed is a different question, but the valuation does give you a safety net. I mean, I'd also add that we spend a lot of time engaging with all the companies in our portfolio, but particularly with the energy companies. And we do this both on our own and in collaboration with other investors. And these companies are changing. There's a lot of work to do. There's no question about that. But they acknowledge the need to change. And if we can support and encourage them on that journey, then so much the better.
You've also got 8% of the portfolio in Japanese equities. And looking through your annual report, it looks like there are 36 individual holdings. Some of these are very, very small proportions. Why so many?
Good spot. I'm glad to see that someone reads the annual report and gets that far through it. So we have a basket of 19 Japanese equity holdings. Those are the smaller ones that you're referring to, which we think are ripe for activism and the realization of, I was going to say hidden value, but in our view, it's not so well hidden value. So if you cast your mind back a few years, one of the arrows of Abenomics was corporate governance reform. And this has resulted in a stewardship code, which has given shareholders real teeth to engage with companies and try and bring about change. And so we've built up a basket of these 19 companies that really fall into three camps, and there's some overlap between these, but there's the sort of parent-subsidiary relationship where a parent owns a large part of a smaller entity, the sort of lazy balance sheet type companies, just where they have far too much cash in their businesses. And then there's the third category where there's activist involvement. And all of those are sort of ripe for change. So the parent-child relationship, the parent-subsidiary relationship might be where you know, the parent buys out the minority interest at a premium in the subsidiary. We've seen quite a lot of activity on the lazy balance sheet type companies, so where dividends and share buybacks are being increased to try and return some of that cash to shareholders. So I think Japan is one of the few markets globally where you know, there's some very low-hanging fruit for this sort of activity.
I guess you'll have your work cut out with the number of companies you have to monitor there. Sorry, one thing I should have asked earlier, but I think it's quite interesting on the inflation side, is infrastructure investment trusts have been very popular this year. We've seen a lot launching. They have a degree of inflation protection built into them through government contracts. It doesn't look like you own them. What do you have thoughts on infrastructure as an asset class and its ability to help protect from inflation?
Yeah. So I'll probably start by saying I am not an expert on this, but clearly, kind of operating in the investment company sphere, yes, you know, we come across this quite a lot. I would come back to what I said earlier and about assets that people panic into. And if you're someone who's holding a lot of cash in your bank account and you suddenly, you know, the penny drops and you say, gosh, you know, I'm actually losing 3, 4, 5% per annum in real terms, what on earth do I own? And you know, that's happening en masse across, you know, many investors, many different geographies. Do you panic into listed infrastructure, or do you go for the purest form of protection, which is, you know, it's got the best covenant, it's, you know, government backed, and there's no dilution of that covenant at all through some other structure? Or do you go for the second degree? I think you panic into gold and the index linked bond side. I think the other element here is the sort of, if it looks like a bond, feels like a bond, then it probably is a bond. So and I don't think this just goes for infrastructure. I think there's quite a lot of alternative asset classes out there that, you know, have been flying off the shelves in an environment of low interest rates. And you have to ask the question, you know, if your discount rate were to rise, would those assets actually, you know, trade on the same valuations? Question mark.
Yeah. And just a few mechanical questions. According to your fact sheet, your annual management charge is 1%. Your closest rivals, what I would consider your closest rivals, Capital Gearing Trust and Personal Assets Trust, have stated their annual management fees as 0.6% and 0.65% respectively. How do you justify your premium?
I quite often hear us compared to a hedge fund, actually. I think, you know, a lot of the strategies that we're employing, you think about payer swaptions, we haven't talked about some of the credit protection we hold. You know, these are things that can really go up in a crisis, rather than, you know, the sort of you know, the insulation, if you like, will go down less than the average in a crisis. So that's quite, we quite often get compared to hedge funds and look like a cheap hedge fund. And I guess the best comparator in our sector to that is BH Macro, and we're, you know, more than half the price of BH Macro.
Okay, great, thanks. And also, I was a bit confused in your annual report. So the trust holds 4 rougher funds, and each make up over 3% of the portfolio. So they're reasonably substantial holdings. In the annual report, it says that for one of these funds, that no management fee is charged by Ruffer AIFM Limited on this investment. So what's the position on the other three? Does that, like, are you charging double management fees?
Very, very good question. No, we never charge double management fees. So some of the Ruffer in-house funds have their own charge levied internally. So we, Ruffer Investment Company, will not charge an additional fee on that. Where they don't have an internal management fee, then it is charged. So no double charging.
Okay, and we're running out of time, but final question. The trust is trading on a 6% premium. It's obviously been very popular. You're doing an open offer in November, which retail investors can participate in. Please, can you tell us about this?
Yeah, I mean, the board are always keen to not to let the premium get too high, because that's not in the interests of long-term investors or people wanting to regularly add to their holdings in the investment company. So the way they've traditionally done that is to issue shares regularly at a small premium, so that it's accretive to existing shareholders, but to people who want to buy. That's been pretty effective. Our premium's been sort of 1-3% range recently. It's crept up to 4 now, and so we're going to keep issuing shares. To do that, we're issuing a prospectus that we will put to shareholders. But at the same time, we thought it was a good opportunity to give existing shareholders the ability to add to their holdings if they want to, and hopefully that will clear some of this demand overhang that's pushing up the premium, and any excess, any rights that aren't taken up will be available to a wider audience. So there'll be more information to come out on this in November, but we're looking to do it in a way that's very friendly to retail shareholders, who make up a significant part of our shareholder base.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Hamish. That's been really interesting. I really appreciate your time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.